From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Voters showed up in full force on Tuesday to vote in midterm races, breaking decades-long records. 114 million people cast ballots for House races, turning over control of the House to Democrats. In comparison, 83 million had voted in 2014. A number of progressives won as well and broke several records, especially women. There's been much talk of a divided nation, and indeed turnout was high among both ends of the political spectrum. Well, what will Democrats do with their newfound power in the House? How will Republicans move from what was in some ways a referendum on the president? How will the nation recover from the racist and nationalist war that appears to be emerging? My guest is Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. His forthcoming book is called Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for our program. Welcome back to the show, Arun.
Great to be with you today, Sonali.
So there were wins, there were losses. In Georgia, Stacey Abrams has still refused to concede, but there were still a number of wins. You're in New York right now, where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez resoundingly beat her Republican opponent to become the youngest member of Congress. How do you assess election night?
Well, I think the Democrats clearly underperformed. When you look at the Senate races, Republicans really did significantly better than anyone thought they would. The fact that they took states such as Indiana and Florida, and I'm not sure what the results are finally in Montana and Arizona, but things were not looking good, as well as Missouri. But then also the governor's races, not just Stacey Abrams, but particularly Andrew Gillum lost, and then Richard Cordray also lost in Ohio. The Democrats really, it would have been incredibly surprising if they did not take back the House. And really, though, we have to step back from this kind of inside baseball handicapping to think about what's going on, that this should have been a Democratic landslide. A president who's putting children in concentration camps, who's instituted a Muslim ban, who's put what looks to be a serial sexual assaulter and certainly perjurer on the Supreme Court, who calls himself a white nationalist and is encouraging anti-Semitic murderers and mail bombers. This is really just a reprehensible administration, and I think at this point, any debate over whether or not Trump is a fascist is over. He's clearly a fascist. That doesn't mean that you go from zero to death camps in 5 seconds. But we have a American fascism, and yet this is the best the Democrats can do.
So those among the Democrats that appeared to do quite well were the outsiders to the party. And I mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. At 29 years old, she becomes the youngest member of Congress. I want to play some highlights from her victory speech on election night. It's quite different, of course, from the victory speeches by other Democrats.
This is what is possible when everyday people come together in the collective realization that all our actions, no matter how small or how large, are powerful, worthwhile, and capable of lasting change. Right now, who we are as a nation is that we have a crooked path, and it is time to make that crooked path straight. We can do better, and we can be better, because a better world is possible. These struggles that we are taking on are generational. These struggles that we are taking on are long. These struggles will not be solved in 2 years or 4 years. It will take our whole lives. But this is the fight for our lives. This is the fight of our lives.
And that is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking on Tuesday night as she declared victory in her race against Republican Anthony Pappas. And this was, of course, no surprise. Arun Gupta, she was very much expected to win because she wasn't expected to beat her, the incumbent in the primary. Now, her words were bold. They were fighting words. She talked about fighting. She said this was the fight of our lives. Do you have any sense that those Republicans who played it, rather Democrats, who played it safe seemed to do worse last night, and those who were bold, like Ocasio-Cortez, won?
Well, I think that shows up most definitely in the U.S. Senate races. That was just really a disaster. Like Schumer was saying in relation to the Kavanaugh nomination, that they were going to play the long game, which essentially meant that they were going to let him be nominated instead of enforcing party discipline. And that really blew up in their face. In terms of those who are bolder, it's been a mixed bag. Certainly there are bright spots like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I also attended the victory party of Julia Salazar. She was another Democratic socialist member. She is running for New York State Senate. And the Democrats now have finally taken back the New York State Senate, and that's huge. They now have control of all three parts of government, the House, the Assembly, and the governorship. So there's no excuse for them not to be able to pass progressive policy. But then you have people like Andrew Cuomo, who was elected, who's really kind of a center-right Republican who poses as a Democrat. This is not going to change overnight in terms of the rightward drift of the country. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, like you had someone like Dianne Feinstein, who was reelected, whereas her opponent was significantly better than she was. The left wing needs to do much more significant base building to be able to take on the Democratic Party machine.
Now, some are looking at the two Joes in the Senate and their votes on Kavanaugh. You had Joe Donnelly, who did vote against Kavanaugh, lost his bid. Joe Manchin, the sole Democrat to vote for Kavanaugh, kept his seat. Is that an indicator that basically his calculus was on the mark? Manchin's calculus was on the mark. He came under a lot of anger from the left for doing what he did.
Not necessarily, because what Manchin really did very effectively was run against the opioid crisis, which his opponent was really implicated in. We have to remember that a lot of these elections, even if I think Trump did nationalize at least the U.S. Senate races, but he failed to do so with the House races, they still very much turn on a lot of local issues. You know, Claire McCaskill, say she certainly didn't help herself with her interview where she talked about crazy Democrats in the last week of the campaign. You have someone like Bill Nelson in Florida. I talked to a Politico who weeks ago told me he was worried that Bill Nelson was going to lose, even though he was leading in the polls, because Bill Nelson was a do-nothing centrist. And, you know, Donnelly just got really trounced in Indiana. And Indiana is a very conservative state. So I'm not sure how much the Kavanaugh issue really affected him when the margin, I think, was nearly 12 percentage points, whether
right.
If he had voted for Kavanaugh, whether that would have helped.
Right. Let's talk about what the Democrats are going to do with their newfound power, Arun. There has been a lot of pushback from the grassroots for Democrats to try to adhere to their stated ideals. One of the things that I'm hearing is that they're planning on demanding Trump's tax returns. Many are pushing them to basically start impeachment proceedings, which is a responsibility that lies with the House. Certainly, they can't pass any real legislation with the Republicans controlling the Senate and the White House. What do you make of the issue of demanding Trump's tax returns and possibly calling for impeachment?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Pelosi comes out and says that impeachment is off the table. Now, more significant, she made a bizarre comment in her victory speech last night. Let's hear it for pre-existing medical conditions. And then she made an appalling comment, which is that the Democrats would seek bipartisanship. And, you know, what does bipartisanship involve with American fascism? Does that mean you shoot only half the immigrants who are coming over the border? Does it mean that you only ban half the Muslims? You know, when the Republicans were wiped out in 2008, Rush Limbaugh said, and the Republicans followed his advice, they need to become the party of no. Now, what the Democrats did in winning the House was a rebuke to Trump. So to like immediately being going out and seeking bipartisanship just shows how out of touch the Democrats are with not just what's going on in their party, but is going on in the country. And so what if they get the tax returns? As we see, none of it matters to Trump's base. I think one thing, though, that's very important to mention, that Trump's base is shrinking. It's very fanatical. It's dangerous. But one thing that we have seen over the last 2 years is that the number of registered Republicans has dropped by 2 points. But he showed a remarkable ability to drive them to the polls. And I think he's still very much in command for 2020 to be reelected.
Absolutely. There's certainly no indication that he's waning or his chances at the polls are waning. So, Arun, how do you hope that the left will move from here? Because voting is one action in a toolkit. In fact, it's quite a minor action. We sort of have to tick it off of our list of things that that one must do to be an active, civically engaged citizen. But unfortunately, for too many Americans, the voting is the single or final action that they take. Do you think that progressives are kind of going to also experience a lot of fatigue and not do much between now and 2020?
That would be an absolutely enormous mistake, you know, and if you recall, we talked in 2016, and I believe both of us caught a lot of flack for saying Trump needed to be stopped at any cost. And yeah. I think a lot of the left made and just an appalling and highly foreseeable mistake in not uniting to try to help defeat Trump, which meant, unfortunately, supporting Hillary Clinton. But that was the reality. So, yes, we can agree that voting does have importance when it's a collective effort. Now, what I constantly argue against is electioneering, actually getting involved in the machinery of elections, except maybe at the local level when you do have left candidates running, like Julia Salazar, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The real change is made in the streets. And then, you know, you need to institutionalize that through the political process. But we need to see a return to militant mass street politics, because otherwise it's going to be an utter disaster. The thing is, we outnumber them. The fascists, the white nationalists, 5-1, 10-1. But the left, liberals, progressives really need to get organized and start to engage in type of militant disruptive activity that raises the cost to the Trump administration. You know, not just protests, but sit downs, disruptions, strikes that really start to show the Trump White House that there are real limits to its power. So we need to go from the voting booth into the streets.
Do you hope, however, that some of the new blood that has entered the Democratic Party in the House, especially not just Ocasio-Cortez, but you have Deb Haaland, you have in New Mexico, you have Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar from Michigan and Minnesota, respectively, who are quite unabashedly strong progressives, and they would be joining the faction that includes the Ro Khannas and Pramila Jayapals in the House? Is it possible that this wing of the party could gain enough political clout within the party to be more responsive to the grassroots pressure?
No. they do not have the ideological unity, control, or discipline to exercise power, that type of ruthless power that the Tea Party caucus did. You know, one of the, they're huge missing ingredients. There are no billionaires who are funding any progressive caucus. There is no Fox News that's hammering the issues for the progressive caucus. And honestly, there also isn't that type of constituency. You know, what the Tea Party really represented was this proto-white nationalist caucus. I was covering the Tea Party from the beginning, and it was very clear. I mean, it began just weeks after Obama was inaugurated that this was kind of this older male white revanchism that had really came to fruition with Trump. And now we see going further and further to the right. And the fact is that the elected left, what there is of it, just lacks that type of fierceness and ruthlessness that the right has. And until it really starts fighting fire with fire, it's going to be irrelevant. They're just going to be going along with Pelosi, because they're just a few dozen members in a caucus of something like 230 Democrats, which has a thin room, thin margin of error.
So what needs to happen between now and 2020? There are a number of issues that people can coalesce around and start pushing for really hard. Among the things that did win, by the way, the ballot box, which is in terms of propositions last night, Arun, which is quite important, is former felons won the right to vote in Florida. A number of Medicaid expansion initiatives won. Some minimum wage initiatives won. Even in these were in Republican states where their state legislatures had been holding back on things like expanding Medicaid and increasing the minimum wage. Are these some of the ways in which grassroots activists can get involved to push for these critical bread and butter issues?
I think that's vital. I see that there's only really two potential candidates who have any hope of taking Trump on. One is to out-Trump Trump, and that's Michael Avenatti. The other is to focus on people's daily lives, on the issues that matter to them, like healthcare, like education, and that person is Bernie Sanders. He's the one who can really appeal to a broad swath of voters. But, you know, the Democratic Party is so corrupt. Bernie Sanders is by far and away the most popular politician in the Democratic Party, and yet the establishment is trying to destroy him because they would rather see Trump remain in power than mild social democracy policies be instituted. But I think if issues like Medicare for All, like minimum wage, I think one of the big issues that is being overlooked is housing issues. Those are becoming huge across the nation. And climate change as well. You know, even if it doesn't poll well, we can't ignore it, the effect of climate change. And then the Democrats also need, the left needs to be much more fierce about issues of race and racism, especially when you have such an explicit racist as president.
Arun, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. I'm sure we'll be having many more conversations over the next couple of years. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, Nation, and Raw Story and Salon. He is also author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, and he's a regular news correspondent for our program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.